I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. First, presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren grilled him about his use of non-disclosure agreements. 2 days later, Mike Bloomberg made headlines by offering to release three women from the ones they signed with his company. Today, we dive into how and why non-disclosure agreements are used and who they benefit the most. We'll find out how common they really are and what you should be leery of before signing one. Then we find out how miniature crime scenes helped advance forensic science and investigation and learn about the woman who broke ground in a male-dominated field that did not welcome her. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Thanks to the white-hot Democratic presidential race, non-disclosure agreements are back in the news. In last week's debate, Senator Elizabeth Warren questioned Michael Bloomberg about his agreements with former female employees. Bloomberg responded by saying he's willing to free three women from their confidentiality agreements that bar them from speaking publicly about sexual harassment or discrimination suits filed against Bloomberg. But what exactly are NDAs, as they're called? How are they used, and whom do they benefit? With us now, Athena Dixon is a partner in the law firm of Ciro Smith Dixon and board president of the Kansas City Metropolitan Bar Association. Athena, it's nice to have you. Welcome.
Good morning.
I want to be clear about something here. Michael Bloomberg is getting a lot of attention for his decision to release these women from their non-disclosure agreements, but he didn't automatically revoke the agreements. In fact, he told the women to contact his company if they wanted to be released. What should I make of that, Athena?
Well, I think that it's important to recognize that he doesn't have the ability to do that completely on his own. This is part of a contract, and there are two parties to it. And so it would be important for the women to be able to be consulted and make new terms to that agreement before it would just be before he would just disclose the terms.
I'm wondering about the women. Would they even know whom to call?
I do believe they would know that. Most agreements do have that information.
You know, in cases like this involving Michael Bloomberg, why do non-disclosure agreements get signed to begin with?
In employment discrimination litigation, most of the time when there is a resolution to it, most agreements do have some form or type of confidentiality associated with it. So that isn't uncommon, not just with Bloomberg, but across the employment arena in these agreements.
What's the point of that? Why confidentiality?
Confidentiality, it's helpful for the terms and conditions of the agreement so that both parties have closure as to when the case is resolved, when the agreement goes into effect. They have the ability to, at least from the plaintiff's perspective, have some kind of closure and move on. And for the company, they have the ability to know this is going to be done and is not going to be brought back up unless certain circumstances exist for it.
But again, why does confidentiality have to be part of this? I mean, if someone's been wronged here, what's the point of confidentiality?
Well, I think that part of it is because a company isn't going to come in and say they're not going to admit to what's happened. By the same token, the plaintiff in the situation or the female, the victim of the, isn't going to want to go to trial and have to talk about what's happened to her. And so the way that we're able to resolve it is we can give control back to the female in this understanding that they come to terms that are agreeable to both parties and allow the victim to move forward.
So you're saying that, in fact, in many cases, I gather that the idea of confidentiality is appealing to both sides, both parties in a dispute.
Absolutely. I think that there is reasons both parties would want to have confidentiality. There are some exceptions to that. But however, for the most part, women in these situations don't want to have to worry about someone knocking on their door in the next week, month, year, and to ask them these questions that have were so that affected them so much.
Right. So the point of a purpose of a non-disclosure agreement then is this allows two parties to resolve a dispute short of going to court, right?
Yes.
Is that the whole point here?
Correct. It gives them the control of knowing how it's going to be resolved versus the when you go to a trial, there's always a winner, there's always a loser. You don't have any control of what position on any given day a jury is going to make.
Mm-hmm.
So the ability to resolve your claims before that does have a lot of appeal to it for both sides because there we could always tell, you know, and an important thing to know is you always have the ability to go to trial and those facts will come out. But to go to trial and risk losing after you've been through all of that, if you can get some certainty and a resolution before that, that's definitely something to be considered.
And typically there's some negotiation over monetary damages here. Is that very par for the course in these things?
Yes. In the civil justice system, the way that we resolve our disputes is monetary. And so most of the time, those are a lot of the terms that are discussed and bargained for and negotiated as part of any kind of settlement agreement.
But what would be the range of possible damages for, say, a sexual harassment situation in the workplace? I mean, I'm guessing what it varies tremendously, right?
It does. Mm-hmm. It would depend on the circumstances. It also depends on what information there is related to it. Unfortunately, a lot of times there's not a lot of documentation that necessarily goes with it. It's more of a he said, she said situation, and those can sometimes be more difficult to prove.
How else do these things wind up getting used in the business world?
There's a lot of ways that they can be used. Proprietary information, trade secrets. There would be information that would be outside of the employment discrimination realm. The way that we typically see them would be after employment has ended to try to resolve claims they had during the employment process.
So typically employment would end in some of these cases. I mean, do people sometimes continue in their jobs?
That does happen, but in most of the cases, the way that there is some kind of what we call an adverse employment action that would either be a termination, demotion, change of pay.
So your point here is that these things are used for a lot more than sexual harassment, discrimination kinds of things. There's a whole world out there of NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, and a whole variety of purposes.
Yes, there is. They use them. The way that we hear them most of the time in the media tends to be related to sexual harassment, but they're used in many different realms of the employment industry.
Do you have any sense, Athena, are they being used more now than maybe they ever have before?
I think they're being used pretty equally as before. I think you just hear about them more now. I've been practicing almost 17 years, and as long as I've been practicing, they've been a part of employment discrimination cases. There are exceptions to that, and I will see what happens with the changes in the future, but I think that it's to be expected that confidentiality agreements would continue in some form.
Why are we hearing about them more now than we have before?
Well, I think with the Me Too movement and everything that's happened, there is a lot more discussion related to it. And I do think that there is more of a mindset to how can we make these the sexual predators and the sexual harassers, how can we stop this behavior? And this is one of the things that has been discussed.
We're talking about non-disclosure agreements, an idea that's very much back in the news this week in the wake of last week's debate, Democratic presidential debate, when Senator Elizabeth Warren questioned Michael Bloomberg about his agreements with former female employees. If you have questions about NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, we're open for business. 816-235-2888 is my phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. I should point out that my guest, Athena Dixon, is one of the presenters at Me Too Discrimination in the Workplace Forum at 6:30 on Tuesday, March 3rd. That's a week from tomorrow at St. Paul's Episcopal Church at 40th and Main in Kansas City, 6:30 a week from tomorrow to talk about some of these issues with Athena Dixon. We're talking about the fact these things tend to be have confidentiality clauses built into them. Athena, how ironclad are these NDAs?
Well, it would depend on the situation. There isn't any kind of uniform agreement. It's done on a case-by-case basis. But there can be different kinds of damages associated with if you were to breach the agreement. So it would depend on each individual settlement agreement.
And breaching the agreement means what? Talking about it?
Disclosing any of the information that has been determined to be confidential under the agreement. So usually it's the amount of money that it's settled for. Sometimes there's something called a non-disparagement clause. So you agree, both parties usually agree not to talk bad about the other. And so that could be something that may have a damage associated with if it's breached. But those are the typical things that would be in a settlement release.
And these things are in effect. They're in force for how long? Forever?
Yes, there isn't any kind, unless it's determined otherwise, unless there would be a time limit associated with it that would be agreed upon. Most of the time is if it's a confidential settlement agreement, it remains confidential throughout the person's life. You don't get a free pass because 10 years has gone by or something like that. By the same token, the company has the same duty, and that's why they aren't allowed to talk about it unless there would be a new agreement entered into by both parties.
You know, you read about these things in different sort of situations that these days when workers get a new job with a new administration in Washington to work for the White House, for instance, sometimes NDAs get signed. Are these things becoming more common? I mean, do people who go to work at certain companies, do you sign one even before you walk in the door the first time?
I think that there may be some things that may be covered under that you would do related to trademark, proprietary information. You're not supposed to talk about things that would be involved in the company and trade secrets. But I don't think that related to employment discrimination, I don't think that it would be against public policy to just agree to not disclose employment discrimination if you feel like you're being treated differently. I think you preserve the right to be able to report that information within the company and report it to the administrative agencies associated with it.
But is it within the realm of reasonableness that I would sign a non-disclosure agreement to say I'm not going to write a book about my experience working in the White House or working for a governor or that kind of thing?
I think that's possible, but I think it's kind of outside my wheelhouse related to what people that are going to work in the White House, what they have to agree to is a little bit different. So I'm not sure how those employees typically handle it.
Yeah. Do you know of any harassment case settlement that did not include an NDA?
There are against public entities sometimes, and not just sexual harassment. There are other race discrimination. There are a certain segment of employers that don't have the ability to have confidentiality releases because they're subject to sunshine or other. And so they sometimes don't happen in those realms, but usually with private employers and private companies, they do.
I'm just struck by what you said earlier, that these things wind up getting resolved behind closed doors. There's a confidentiality idea attached to these things, when in so many cases, as you pointed out, it's a he said, she said kind of situation. It's one person's word against the other. I mean, why would anyone want to settle a case in a situation like that when it's so hard to prove?
So there are ways that we prove employment discrimination cases that even if there is a he said, she said situation, you just look at the facts associated around it, and the timing is important usually. And there is discovery that can be done when a lawsuit is filed that would allow the ability to see what additional facts are out there. So to say that it's always he said, she said is difficult to say. But in the majority of the situations, the conversations that are happening, those are the parts in the situations that you have to know that are hard to prove.
You know, can you make a case here, Athena, that these agreements involving sometimes rich and powerful men are simply a way for these men to continue to exploit women because they have the resources to do it, and it keeps word of what they're doing private, and you're sort of perpetuating the problem, but in effect, by signing one of these things?
I think that argument can be made, and I could see if you look at certain situations, absolutely that is happening, and it is allowing an individual to keep harassing other individuals in different situations. And so, yes, I see that argument, but it isn't in the employment discrimination, at least within our community, it is more to protect both individuals from the situation and to protect from going to trial and what could go with that appeal. Timing is another thing. It takes an incredibly long time to pursue an employment discrimination claim. And if it were to go to trial and be appealed and move forward, sometimes it takes anywhere 3, 5, 7 years. And so there's some certainty that comes with being able to resolve it in a shorter amount of time.
And the court costs in a situation like that have to be monumental, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Are there time limits as to how long an NDA can last? I think we talked, sometimes they're in the lifetime of someone who might have been the perpetrator here, right?
Most of the time, it is for, you're just not going to speak about it. It's an indefinite amount of time. There are times where you could try to, if it's related to a certain instance, you could try to put a time limit on that, but you would do it in the release itself.
Yeah. What does it take to get someone released from an NDA? You talked about that earlier, that both parties have to be involved here, Athena, but what's involved with that?
I think the main thing would be this is at its core a contract. And so you would have to figure out offer, acceptance, consideration. Those are the things that we look at when we're entering into a contract. So for the terms to be changed, you have to have a meeting of the minds as to the new terms. And so I think that would be the first step.
In a situation like Bloomberg's, if you're going to change it so you allow confidentiality, what else might be under discussion to make that happen? Would the financial settlement change, or would something like that be involved?
Well, I think that it would depend on what is being sought. So is it simply that we're no longer going to have any kind of agreement as to confidentiality? And does that include a non-disparagement? What does that include? What does it look like? And if it's something where monetary needs to be discussed again, which I'm assuming that it may be in certain situations, definitely, if you're looking at that, that would be something that would need to be discussed. But I think that you have to go back and just you're starting from scratch. And so you want to look at what that looks like between the two parties.
Yeah. To what extent did Senator Warren really put Michael Bloomberg on the hot seat last week when he talked about this idea that he should disclose what these NDAs were all about?
I think that it did put him in that position.
Because he can't talk about it based on what you're saying here today.
Right. But I think that's also – I think that as far as what he's able to say and not able to say, if he would have started talking about the situations related to that employment, he would be breaching the agreement. So, I mean, I think that you have to be very – once an agreement is entered into, one party can't change it.
Yeah. So, in a sense, it's politically, it's like a blunt object that's a hammer hitting somebody with, because Michael Bloomberg is sort of limited as to what he can say here.
Right.
Boy, wow. Okay. How are NDAs as part of a settlement agreement perceived, Athena? I mean, is there assumed guilt about the accused and assumed greed about the plaintiff here?
I don't think so, because as attorneys, it has just become a common practice of what typically happens in employment discrimination cases. Additionally, I don't think that there's necessarily just because a company settles a case doesn't mean that they've done anything wrong. And just because a plaintiff accepts a settlement doesn't mean that he or she has done it for the wrong purposes. Mm-hmm. I think it's just a way for the parties to be able to resolve their differences without the uncertainty of trial. And I think that in most arenas in the civil justice system, you will see settlements and agreements happening. Whether or not they involve confidentiality or not, you will see resolution of claims. There's a statistic that the majority of cases are not tried. And so if they're not tried, that means they're getting settled. And if they're getting settled, what are the terms of the settlement looking like? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the more important thing, is the confidentiality is not unusual. And I don't believe that it paints anyone into a different light. I just think that at some point the parties have decided that they would like control over whether or not to be able to resolve their claims, or are they going to move forward and let a jury decide?
Interesting. Well, Athena Dixon, again, one of the presenters at a Me Too event, Me Too Discrimination in the Workplace, at 6:30 next Tuesday, March 3rd, at St. Paul's Episcopal Church at 40th and Main in Kansas City. Athena, thanks for enlightening us about all this. I think a lot of people weren't sure they knew a whole lot about this murky world of NDAs. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Again, Athena Dixon, a partner in the law firm Ciro Smith Dixon. After a short break, we'll come back and we'll talk about the woman who invented modern-day forensic science and the struggles she faced in trying to get all that done. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. It's Monday, which means my newsletter arrives in your inbox today. If it doesn't, that's because you haven't signed up at kcur.org/Kraske. In Kraske Off Mic, you'll get exclusive content from me and recaps of shows you may have missed. Sign up at kcur.org/Kraske. Tuesday on the program, the transformations media have made in political speech. One communications professor analyzes the change in presidential rhetoric over the past several decades. We'll talk about it tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, there was a time in this country when murder sometimes went unnoticed because police and other investigators weren't good at distinguishing natural death from homicide. Even police back in the day thought autopsies were unnecessary and even distasteful. Incompetence reigned. Enter a remarkable woman, Frances Lee, who saw the need for the study of legal medicine or forensics and then launched the program via a gift from her own estate. There was no less in the creation of a new field of medicine, and she aided that new field with her own nutshell studies of unexplained death, which were scale model dioramas of crime scenes that were actually pieces of art in their own right. Bruce Goldfarb has written a new biography of Frances Lee titled 18 Tiny Deaths, The Untold Story of Frances Glessner Lee and the Invention of Modern Forensics. He's an executive assistant to the chief medical examiner in Maryland, where he maintains the nutshell studies. He joins us this morning from NPR in Washington, and he'll be in town for an event in early March. More on that in just a little bit. Bruce, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, tell us about Frances's nutshell studies of unexplained death, and how in the world did they get that name, Bruce?
Well, they are a series of dollhouse-like dioramas in a scale of 1 inch to 1 foot, and they're exquisitely detailed, and they're living rooms and bedrooms and residential scenes for the most part. There's one exterior and one garage.
What was she trying to achieve with these things?
She wanted to create a way of practicing observation, how to look at something and note things that may be significant, that could be evidence, and report your observations. And that's the other big important part of it, is to summarize what you see and explain it to somebody else.
Well, what kind of thing might she have been trying to emphasize here? What's an example of something that you might not see at the scene that maybe the diorama could help you figure out?
Well, it's not uncommon, for example, for somebody to make a homicide stage it to look like it's a suicide, or for somebody who takes their own life to make it look like an accident or a homicide in order to collect for the insurance, for example. And so in several of the dioramas, the takeaway simply is that something's not adding up. What you're being told does not match with what you see, what the facts are. And so that might suggest an avenue that would be worth investigating.
I mean, this is classic detective work, right?
It's exactly what it is.
Yeah. I mean, these dioramas, as you've mentioned, were extraordinarily intricate and extraordinarily detailed. I'm wondering why, and give us, again, an example of just how far Frances went here.
Well, you know, she was creating these dioramas for study by what at the time was, there were adult men, police officers, and so she didn't want anything that was remotely doll-like or toy-like, so they would be taken seriously, but also they had to be very vividly filled with details, because You know, if you just had a scene where there was a clean room and one piece of evidence, there's a bloody knife on the floor, it's sort of obvious what you're supposed to look at. But you know, if you fill it with clutter, as you know, lives are in real life, and things are much more ambiguous, and you don't know what to look at, you really have to examine every little thing in the room. So it's really intended to overwhelm the eye.
Did she expect that police departments would want to copy this idea and build their own dioramas?
I don't know whether other I don't know whether that was her intent. You know, she did write about these three-dimensional objects as very useful teaching tools and those sorts of things. There is actually a resurgence in the use of models in the same scale for teaching purposes. And there's at the University of Northern Michigan, there's a program where they the group has recreated the Jeffrey McDonald fatal vision murder scene.
Oh, wow.
And all the supporting materials. And students get to reinvestigate that case from scratch. It's really a tremendous exercise.
You know, much of her life was about trying to find something to do with herself in the years that she had on this earth. Why was that such a struggle for her?
She was a child of privilege. She grew up, she was born in 1878, and her father, her family was fabulously wealthy. Her dad owned a piece of International Harvester, and the children really wanted for nothing. They were homeschooled by, you know, in the arts and music and horseback riding and dancing and all sorts of things, and whatever they wanted. It was a life of unimaginable privilege. And by the time she came of age, you know, she'd been instilled all this knowledge and training and everything. And then just sort of, you know, her brother went off to Harvard. He studied at Harvard, intending to go for a law degree. But she didn't, you know, then what do you do with the rest of your life? You can go to so many cocktail parties and receptions and afternoon teas and lectures of the Decorative Art Society and those sorts of things.
She wanted more than that.
And she wanted to give back. She'd said that, you know, she was born with a silver spoon in her mouth, and she never had to do a day of work for what she had. And she really felt that she had a need to provide, you know, pay back to, you know, justify her existence. She really did feel that very deeply.
So in a sense, her wealth offered her inspiration in a roundabout way.
It allowed her the means. I mean, everybody's, you know, anybody, it's easy to get ideas, but to actually, you know, act on them and see things through, she had the resources to do that.
You know, in the late 1920s, she got lucky during an extended recovery following surgery. She went to stay at a place called the Phillips House in Boston. As it turned out, to recover, a man named George Burgess McGrath was also staying there. This turned out to be perhaps the most pivotal moment of her life. Who was George Burgess McGrath?
McGrath was, he went to school with Francis's brother, George. They're the two Georges, and Francis knew him. They were friends when she was a teenager, and they went to the Chicago World's Fair at the 1893 World's Fair and rode the Ferris wheel and those sorts of things. And then, you know, she kept up with what he was doing. He was appointed a medical examiner in Boston. He was actually the first pathologist to be appointed as a medical examiner, so he was literally America's first forensic pathologist. And he was the Emmy on a number of high-profile cases, the Sacco and Vanzetti case, the 1919 molasses disaster that many people are probably familiar with, and those sorts of things. So he got a reputation as a crime doctor. And it was when she was 52 years old in 1929 when she reestablished that relationship with him. By then, she was at a low point in her life, and her brother had died, and she was rather, you know,
she was
depressed.
Divorced, too, at that point, right?
Oh, she had been long divorced. Yeah, mm-hmm. She was divorced in the early 1900s. So she was, you know, quite alone. And then here comes McGrath, who is really, by this time, you know, her oldest and dearest friend that was still around. And he really understood her like nobody else did.
The two of them spent a lot of time together talking as they recovered from, I guess, various ailments here. Frances, absolutely fascinated by George's work. What do you suppose he told her during those long talks, sometimes sitting on, I guess, the porches at this home in Boston?
Yeah, he probably told her a lot of what I tell people, and people assume, you see these TV shows, and you think that an unexpected or suspicious death is investigated with this, you know, a team of experts, and they do a CSI-type investigation, and everything's very thoroughly looked into, but actually, in a lot of the country, that's just not the case. And so, you know, I think that, you know, he impressed upon her, you know, the differences between the coroner system and a, you know, a modern scientific medical model, medical examiner system. And
Told her stories of some of the cases that he had worked on, right? In pretty graphic detail.
Oh, yes. Oh, he was a great storyteller. And she was just absolutely fascinated. And these were things that, you know, really mattered. And these were weighty subjects and, you know, talking about justice. And not just, you know, she was as interested in or perhaps more concerned about people who were unjustly convicted, clearing the innocent, as she was about convicting the guilty. They're two sides of the same coin. And both are very important to her. Which gets back to your question, by the way, about where this name came from, the Nutshell Studies of Unexplained Death, because she said that the purpose, the investigator is supposed to clear the innocent, convict the guilty, and find the truth in a nutshell. So each one of these dioramas is a truth in a nutshell.
You know, just guessing here, as you looked at worked on this biography here, Bruce, that you would have paid real money to have sat on the porch with them for a spell back at that time to hear what in the world they were talking about.
I have searched, people have looked, there's no video, there's no audio of her. I know that she did a radio show in the 1950s, and it would be, yeah, absolutely, I would love to hear her voice and to get her thoughts about things today and those sorts of things, if I only had the opportunity.
But there's absolutely no question that her visit to Philip's house and her encounter with George Burgess McGrath there absolutely changes her life.
It sent her life in quite an unusual and unexpected direction, yeah.
And what did she do next?
Well, what happened was that George McGrath made this sort of offhand weird remark, and they're just chattering and talking, and he said, you know, I've always thought that the organs of the human body are the most decorative objects in the world, and would just be worthy of a art piece or a mural to hang in an office somewhere, and that got her to thinking about whether it's really so. So she just went literally years, and she went to museums and libraries and hired people and studied ancient cultures and burial practices and books on the theories of colors and gems and all these things, and she. What she ended up doing was producing a manuscript, but it also led to her realizing that basically, you know, I think that the bottom line is we're all beautiful inside, and that, you know, everybody deserves a very thorough scientific investigation, that, you know, every person matters and all that. So it led her to support George McGrath's work and then later found the Department of Legal Medicine at Harvard University.
I was going to say, this really helps her decide she wants to help further the cause of forensic medicine. So in 1931, speaking of Harvard, she went to the president of Harvard with a proposal. What did she want to do?
She wanted to create, from the ground up, an entire new department, an entire field of academic medicine, which was then called legal medicine, which is the service of medicine in the service of law and justice. And so, you know, that would require hiring faculty, you need laboratories, you need, you know, I think of all these things, you need a library, you need resource materials, you need a photo collection, you need x-rays, and you need people, you need staff, and all these things, because nothing like that existed. You know, in order to transition from this archaic throwback of the coroner system to a modern medical examiner system, you need three things. You need the manpower to do that, which is what she did at Harvard. You need training programs to produce medical examiners. And you also need to change state laws to abolish the coroner system and move to a medical examiner system. And then the third part was the training the police, because they're the first responders and they're at the scene.
Hmm. Bruce Goldfarb will be discussing his new book, 18 Tiny Deaths, The Untold Story of Francis Glessner Lee and the Invention of Modern Forensics, Sunday, March 8th, so a little while here before he comes to town, at the National Museum of Toys and Miniatures. More information at the Toy and Miniature Museum website, that's toyandminiaturemuseum.org, and on our website this afternoon at kcur.org/up-to-date. You write out the proposal that Francis made to Harvard. You write this: what she was suggesting was nothing less than creating an entirely new field of medical practice from the ground up. So this was a big deal. It was her moment, right?
It sure was, and it was a big deal. I can't think of the last time, a whole new area of medical specialty, well, maybe emergency medicine in the 1970s, but those things don't happen. It's a generational thing, and it was it was a big deal then, and it's a big deal now.
Hmm. What did Harvard do with the money she gave them, and how much did she give?
She gave them, out of her initial gift was the equivalent of around $3.8 million.
Wow.
As an endowment. And her the intention was that a lot of that was in International Harvester stock, so it would produce dividends that would support the department on an ongoing basis. She paid for things out of her own pocket. The homicide seminar that she did every year, these dinners cost $25,000 each, and aside from the dioramas, she acquired other teaching models. She spent thousands and thousands on providing for the department.
So she was all in here.
Oh, she was absolutely all in. She spent literally, she spent a fortune.
Hmm. Yeah. If you have a question for Bruce Goldfarb, our number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So at the time, Bruce, how faulty a practice was law enforcement investigation of homicides around the country and for that matter, other major crimes as well?
Well, at the time that she started to get involved in it, in 1929, medical examiners were only existing in basically two places. They were in Boston, Massachusetts, and the city of New York itself. And for the rest of the country, it was on the corner system. And, the practice was spotty. They don't teach about death investigation in medical schools because medical students are expected to treat living people. So why teach them about decomposition and these sorts of things? And the problem with the coroner system is that it's a political position. And not to say that all coroners were bad, but it is prone to abuses, corruption, indifference, incompetence, and those sorts of things. So it was generally unsatisfactory.
These were political appointees you're describing, not people who had studied science and medicine at a major university.
Yeah, in many places it was and still is. You're elected to office in states such as Indiana, where I just was, Missouri. The qualification to be coroner is that you are over 18 and older and are elected to office. And that's pretty much it. Then you're signing death certificates.
So is it fair to conclude then that we're seeing across the country still some things haven't changed that much but since before Francis came along?
As of right now, about half the country is still on the coroner system. About half the population is on the coroner system, and half is covered under a medical examiner system.
Meaning that in some places there are people who oversee death investigations who might struggle to tell whether a death is by natural causes or by homicide.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to distinguish between homicide, suicide, and accident. Mm-hmm. It's really important there. But in most of the cities and major urban areas are covered by medical examiners generally, but still about half the population is still under the coroner system.
What do you make of that?
Well, it takes money. My former boss, Dr. Fowler, said that living people don't like to spend money and dead people don't vote. So, it's not like there's a... It's one of these things that sort of operates in the background, and you don't think about, your utilities or the air traffic control and these things that are sort of humming in the background and work until something goes wrong. So... It's the coroner system. The coroner is typically a county coroner, so it's a local political official, and localities don't want to give up that authority and that political position to the state. And there's a variety of reasons.
But still, it's fairly disturbing that we have, in some cases, untrained people making these determinations, right?
You're not going to get an argument from me on that.
Yeah.
You're speaking to the choir. Yes, it is disturbing that in some places there are unqualified people who are signing death certificates. I think that's quite a safe statement to say.
But you don't hear this being rating as a political issue in many locations that I've come across.
There are John Oliver did a wonderful segment back in May on This Week Tonight. You can Google that. It was just called Death Investigation, a tremendous one. ProPublica and NPR they did a program on Frontline some not long ago. That's called Postmortem. If you look for it, it's not the sort of thing that makes the papers every day. But if you look for it, you'll find that there are problems from coast to coast.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and I'm visiting with author Bruce Goldfarb about his new book, 18 Tiny Deaths, The Untold Story of Frances Glessner Lee and the Invention of Modern Forensics. She invents modern forensics, an amazing woman. If you have any questions for us, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. In the 40s, Frances planned and hosted again at her own expense. That's a refrain we're hearing a lot here, these annual seminars at Harvard for police officers around the country. What would happen at those seminars?
It was 5 days. It was a week-long seminar, very intensive all day, and the curriculum has changed very little to this day. And they would learn not to make them medical examiners, but to teach them what a medical forensic investigation can show. So they would learn about blunt force injuries and sharp force injuries and suffocation and drowning and all these sorts of things. They'd observe an autopsy. But they would also go out for a fancy dinner, and Frances treated them to probably one of the best meals of their life, served on gilt-edged china, and the centerpieces alone cost $3,000 back
in
the day.
No kidding.
So, she spent a fortune on these things, and she expected them to treat to behave as gentlemen, that they were well-trained and elite. They had this obligation. They'd been given this gift of... this training, and they had now a duty now to serve.
Yeah, I don't want to get too graphic here, but why is it hard sometimes to distinguish suicide from homicide?
Because people only leave notes in about 20% of cases, for one thing, and it's the nature of people who want to cover up their acts that things on TV shows. Things tend to be very black and white and clear cut and obvious and these sorts of things, but real life is not as neat as television or the movies are, and things aren't as clear, and there's a lot of ambiguity and uncertainty until you look further. So it can be really difficult to tell if somebody you don't know what's in somebody's mind. So it's really difficult to know what their purpose was or what their intent was.
And just by viewing the body, you can't tell.
Sometimes you can. It depends on the circumstances.
Mm-hmm. So also in the 40s, she begins building her nutshell studies. How were those things received?
Oh, immediately. There was nothing else like it. I mean, the officers got it right away, and they were totally right from the get-go. They were extremely valuable tools for this practice, for this purpose. And so they were received quite well.
Did those dioramas result in anybody cracking any cases, Bruce?
What they did was to teach you to observe a scene. People want to know if there's any specific. Can you point to a specific case where somebody said? And I didn't find anything like that. But I've had many police officers tell me that who've there's. that these dioramas are as close as you can get to an actual crime scene. So if you really wanted to see what a crime scene looks like, this is what it looks like. And there's just no, in terms of providing that experience to practice looking and observing, there's nothing else like it.
And where are those dioramas today?
They are they're located in the building where I work, at the Forensic Medical Center for the State of Maryland, located in Baltimore.
Do people still come to look at them?
Unfortunately, they're not open to the general public because they were on exhibition at the Smithsonian at the Renwick Gallery a couple years ago, and 100,000 people went to go see them. But unfortunately, Francis's own wishes were that they were to be used for teaching and not exhibition. And sadly, we are a working state forensic medical center, and we just can't have people dropping in and seeing them at all hours.
But the Smithsonian actually was interested in these things.
They were indeed.
Wow.
And they came up and they underwent months and months of just amazing conservation work by a team at the American Art Museum.
You know, she would say as she grew older that she had led a lonely and rather terrifying life.
Yep.
What do you think she meant?
What I know she meant was that she was by nature, a quiet person and reserved person. And this whole thing with making legal medicine grow forced her to interact with people and to lobby people and to change minds and to go and, you know, she was forced into the sphere that she was not her first nature, and she was really pushed to do this because nobody else was doing it. Mm-hmm. And so in many times she was really pretty much the only voice, and that must have been quite lonely. And just being put into these situations where, you know, there's no roadmap, you don't not really sure if this is what you should be doing. So that's what I take away from what she's saying there. She personally had a very rewarding and enriched life, and she also said that too.
Let's get a quick phone call here from Ellen from Overland Park. Ellen, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, or almost afternoon. I either read or heard somewhere that there was a movie made about the Nutshell Studies, and I went looking for it and could not find it anywhere. Is that accurate, and is there any way to find it?
There is a documentary that was done by Susan Marks of Minneapolis. It's called Of Dolls and Murder. I believe
that's
that
a good
is.
Title. Yeah.
I think it's on YouTube. I'm not sure. And Susan is doing a fuller documentary that will, my understanding is, will be on PBS this fall. I'm in it, so you can either look for what's on YouTube or wait for the good stuff with me in it in the fall. Yeah.
Again, Bruce will discuss his new book, 18 Tiny Deaths, a week from Sunday, March 8th, at the National Museum of Toys and Miniatures. More information on the museum's website. Bruce, I sure enjoyed the conversation. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. This was great.
You bet. Tuesday, we're talking college hoops with a look at the dominating teams in the region and about the return of the Big 12 Women's Championship to Kansas City. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.